We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board, while Will Erskine booking the guests in the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. Where are we today? Pretty much where we were yesterday. So where do we start? You know, there's a poll out. Oh, no, before we get, the Leafs won! Wait a sec. There you go. That's about all they're going to get. The Leafs won last night, which was quite a situation in the Thompson household, because there's two people that are Leafs fans and there's two people that are Boston fans. And it was so funny because all the Boston fans, and I'm not even going to name them anymore, the Boston fans were all kind of snotty. Well, you know, Toronto's going to take it in five. Toronto's going to take it in five. Toronto's going to be... And they're sort of like already like giving up. Give it up on Boston, because Toronto, yeah, you know, but that's all a strategy. And then, of course, you know, game one Saturday night, enough of that mess. But last night, when all of a sudden things started to turn around, and, you know, I noticed a very much a different attitude in my son. He went from not giving a rat's rear end and barely even staring at me or looking up from his phone when I'm talking about the big game to like screaming and yelling at the top of his lungs. And I'm looking at him like, what is with you? You did not care about this. But now all of a sudden he does. And then, of course, the Leafs score and he stands up and I'm doing the grunting movement that he's doing now. But it's radio, so you don't know what the hell I'm doing. But I'm like, you know, grinding my hips when they scored. And then, of course, Boston meaning. And then, I gave it away, didn't I? And then, 9-10 seconds later, the Leafs score, and I'm standing up going, woo, 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 woo. And that's when I threw my back out, and then the whole, no, I'm just kidding. So, it was fascinating because these Boston fans, then, Leafs a better team. Yeah, you know, maybe five, whatever. And then all of a sudden, you know, as soon as they get a smell of the win, boy, they become different people, don't they? And it was quite an exciting game, and half the house went to bed happy. And the other half didn't care. No, I'll leave it up to them. All right, so at least it makes it exciting. And I've just spent a couple of minutes talking about something much more enjoyable than the Prime Minister. But on that note, a new Ipsos poll is out. And we all remember the pre-budget Justin Trudeau roadside distraction tour, where he took like 3 weeks to unveil the budget. And every day it was another bonbon and another $1 billion. And basically all that was left to do on budget day was tell us how much it was going to cost, and then he was going to tax the family cottage, which, because apparently only rich people have cottages. The average middle-class Canadian does not own a cottage, apparently. So now we're getting Ipsos polling out, and like 65% do not approve of the management of the country. It has not even moved the needle whatsoever. People are just tuning out. So there you go. Lack of management in every department. We're seeing it in every demographic and everywhere across the country, except Quebec, where the separatist Bloc Québécois are still holding power and gaining momentum, I guess. So it's interesting how, you know, the Prime Minister doesn't really, you know, it's never been the economy's never really been a priority for him, because he's like living off the credit card. And he makes horrible management mistakes. The population situation with, you know, creating, advancing the crisis in housing and healthcare, and right the way down to shelter systems and stuff. So, you know, he mismanages and then he taxes us to fix it. And he calls that fair. Well, how's that fair? Because he's the ultra rich. He ain't feeling it. He's living off dad's money. And all the connections and his friends on faraway islands and such. And, you know, Bob Ray once said, you can't pay for programs without prosperity. And that's exactly what Justin Trudeau's finding out. They're out of cash, out of your cash. And he's certainly not going to budge on the carbon tax. It's got nothing to do with the environment, because he needs the money. And, you know, I think it was the Canadian Chamber of Commerce said earlier, or late last week, that redistribution of wealth doesn't create wealth. That's not wealth creation. Bringing in business opportunity, innovation, investment, productivity, all down. So you can't pay for any of this if you're not managing the country. Innovation, investment, productivity, all down. That's the Bank of Canada saying, break the glass. We got a problem here. So I guess you just keep taxing until you eventually hit a sweet spot again that's going to buy you some votes. And the sad part is it's down we all go because he can't let go and give it to somebody else for a change. It's sad. It really is. For everybody. Remember during post-pandemic, post-COVID-19, we couldn't wait to get out. Everybody thought it was going to be like the roaring 20s. So like opening up the barn door and everybody's just stampeding out into the field of daisies. I mean, you know, and I guess it did for a bit. And then all of a sudden, affordability became an issue and people started thinking, where's my money going? Certainly within hospitality, has that translated over to the music industry? When it comes to going out and seeing your favorite act, whether it's in your local concert hall or whether it's in a giant festival stadium type setting. Let's bring in Alan Cross, music historian, host of the ongoing History of New Music, and here now. Alan, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am doing okay.
So your thoughts on this, and I've read the column that you can find on Global News, and is this pretty much just the festivals, or is this right across the board?
Well, my column focused on festivals simply because there seems to be a real lack of enthusiasm for a lot of the big shows that everyone used to look forward to every single summer. Coachella, for example, took weeks and weeks and weeks to sell out the first weekend. And I'm not sure about what happened with the second weekend, but I checked on the Thursday and there were still tickets available. And then if you look at some of the other festivals, there's not a lot of excitement going on. And I think there's a bunch of reasons why this is the meh concert season, if you want to get into that.
Is it a cyclical thing? Are there times when big festivals are more in vogue, times where they're not? Do they come back? Is it cyclical?
It might be, but we're not really sure. There are a number of unique things that are happening right now. You alluded to it with the funflation, this idea that after the pandemic, we were all going to go out and spend money on ourselves, you know, doing pleasurable things like travel, going to festivals, and so on. We did that for a couple of years, and then interest rates went up. And then also last year, Beyonce and Taylor Swift sucked an awful lot of concert dollars out of the marketplace. So now in 2024, you know, is there money left over? It's hard to say. So that's one reason. Gen Z is also not really playing along. It turns out, or it seems to be turning out, that they are not as into going to festivals as boomers, Gen X, and millennials. They have been dubbed the sensible generation, meaning that, you know, they don't do a lot of really goofy things. There was one survey that said that of all Gen Z's surveyed, that only 5% said that they would go to a festival and drink and do drugs. 5%. Now, that's good, which is why they're generation sensible, but it's a different thing. The other thing, too, is Gen Z is the online generation. Their circle of friends tend to be virtual, and they're not necessarily, you know, as keen to hang out in a giant crowd of people in a field over a weekend. So that could be an issue here. It's a generational demographic sort of thing. There's an interest rate problem, not only for people who have to pay higher credit card bills and so on, but part of the reason the festival scene really did well in the 2010s was because interest rates were low and promoters and people who wanted to stage festivals could borrow money at cheap rates. That's not happening anymore.
Yeah.
And finally, and this is the big one, I think we've got a music problem. And it's because we've done a very lousy job of creating new superstars, new headline acts in the 21st century. The ones that do exist, you know, Taylor Swift, Beyonce, they don't need the hassle of appearing at a festival where they would have to scale down their show and interrupt any sort of tour. No, they would rather just go out on their own and make oodles and oodles and oodles of money.
You talked about the music industry, Alan. Is that because when you really think about it, to the days, when you started or I started, there really isn't, or there isn't much of a music industry anymore? It's completely changed. The template's different.
Yeah, it's certainly not the way it used to be, where everybody agreed that these select group of artists were good and were big and deserved our money. With streaming and the availability of music to anybody, anytime, anywhere, has in some ways devalued the mystery and the appeal of a lot of music. There is no center to the music industry anymore. It's gone. Everybody's doing their own thing, which is, you know, a democratizing thing. You can choose whatever music you want. You can choose not to participate. You can choose not to have certain types of music shoved down your throats. That's great. But at the same time, it has a deleterious effect on the rest of the industry in the sense that things aren't as big, with the exception of Beyonce and Taylor Swift. The artists, the big artists that we have today, are nowhere near as big as artists used to be back in the day.
So everything needs, whatever industry it is, it needs to generate a new audience, a new generation of followers. So is this the slow demise of the festival circuit?
I don't think so, because there's a lot of momentum behind this, but promoters are going to have to figure out what Gen Z really wants in order to get them out to a festival. Boomers aren't going to stand in a field anymore. Gen Xers aren't interested in standing in a field anymore. Millennials are reaching that age, so you got to go for Gen Z. And that means you have to appeal to a whole bunch of different artists. There's no way that you're going to get a Gen Z out to see the Eagles or Springsteen or any of these other acts, because, you know, it's just not their thing. It's their parents' or even their grandparents' music. And you're not going to get boomers to get out of their house and stand in a field to see Springsteen anymore when it's much more comfortable to go see him in an arena. Hmm.
So let me ask you this. We've only got a few seconds left. Could we see a smaller, more intimate type of setting? Could we see the resurgence of the music club?
We might. Now, there are a lot of smaller events, a lot of smaller festivals that specialize in certain things, like metal, for example, and hard rock. And they do well. I mean, there's, you know, we're not talking about 250,000 people over the course of a weekend. We're talking 15 or 20,000. So your costs are are lower. Your overhead is more manageable. Your fan base is targeted. See, the problem with a Coachella or a Lollapalooza or a Bonnaroo is that you cast your net really, really wide. And if you look at, you know, the lineup on Friday and then you look at the lineup on Sunday, you may like one but really hate the other. And then if you look at the small font bands, the ones that, below the headliners, there's a lot of them that you've never seen before. So how are you going to get people out to see them?
Alan Cross with us, music historian, host of the ongoing History of New Music. Lack of enthusiasm when it comes to the big music fest. Alan, thanks as always so much for the time. Be well.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Ottawa plans to turn some post office and historic armories into housing. The idea outlined in the federal budget to use federally owned sites across the country to help ease the Canada-wide housing crunch. What does this mean moving forward? Frank Clayton with a senior research fellow with the Center for Urban Research and Land Development, Toronto Metropolitan University, and is here now. Oh, we just lost him. So there's a lot of government owned land throughout the country. There's a lot of land that is no longer being used, buildings that are no longer being used. So obviously, as we talk about increasing density, one of the ways in order to do that is to take some of these government buildings that are no longer being used and repurpose them in some way in order to make them into housing. Obviously, this isn't going to solve the problem. There's not that much of it, but obviously in downtown areas and certain historic areas, obviously it could be a big help. So to talk more about all of this, bring in Frank Clayton, senior research fellow with the Center for Urban Research and Land Development, Toronto Metropolitan University, and here now. Frank, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am fine, Scott.
So it sounds like this is a pretty good idea, Frank. What are the challenges? Is there enough of this to make a substantial dent?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
It's not to take existing buildings and convert them. That's a long process. A lot of costing has to be done. A lot of them are heritage buildings, so you got to preserve part of them. It's not if you want to get housing built fast. This isn't the way to go.
So, is it about increasing housing, or is it about repurposing land for the government?
Well, if they're going to take buildings, existing buildings, and tear them down and build new and make the land available for affordable housing, say, that's a very good thing. New projects, that is. That's much faster than taking existing buildings and trying to figure out if they can actually have the characteristics which make them amenable for conversion and costing them all out and so on, and then actually do the work. It's much quicker to tear things down and build new buildings.
Obviously, this sounds good when you're selling a budget, but what is the plan here? What is the idea? What are they trying to do? What is the devil in the details, as they say?
Well, the feds have been doing this for some time over the last 15 or 20 years, taking surplus sites and making them available for affordable housing. And that's what they're doing. And if they've got obsolete sites or sites that are underutilized, that makes some sense to do. But take existing buildings. One of the problems is that a lot of them are heritage buildings. So it takes, you've got to protect part of them, and then that affects the density and affects the construction, how you construct and so on. There can be nice buildings. There's one in Toronto on Yonge Street, just north of Eglinton, an old post office, and they built them behind it, and they made it into a restaurant at the front of it. And it keeps the facade of the post office, so it's quite a nice looking complex. But that all takes time. It took years to build that. So I think it's just more public relations right now.
Yeah. Is affordable housing actually subsidized housing? So would this, is the idea here behind selling this to a developer who then they would provide subsidized housing for the tenants, or is this about the government becoming a landlord?
Well, I think what the government will do, if they're wise, they would not sell the land. They would lease it on a long-term basis for affordable housing, so that affordable housing provider, say a nonprofit group, would get the land basically for free. So that would reduce their costs by maybe 15% or 20% right off the bat to build a new product. It's more likely what their thrust of the federal programs to get more rental housing built, that it would be definitely rental, but whether it would be affordable in the sense of social housing or affordable in the sense of just below market rent, which is there's different definitions of affordability, I can't say.
But in order for that to, I guess, be efficient, affordable, it most likely has to be a teardown, would it not? Especially if it was for subsidized or some sort of affordable housing.
I would think so, because buildings, we got this fad going on right now, taking office buildings with high vacancy rates and saying, oh, let's convert them to residential. But it turns out that only maybe 10 or 15% of the office buildings actually have the attributes to make them useful or amenable to residential conversion. So that's probably the same with post offices and armories. They have to have the configuration to make it all work, so it's probably better off to start with a teardown.
So, and many, as you've said, Frank, especially with the housing crisis where it is, and people working from home, creating more office vacancy and such, that why not convert office space to residential? But that's a lot more difficult a task than what it looks like from the street.
Oh, it is. It's a very, very difficult cat. There's one of the first developers in Calgary, for example, which started this conversion program because Calgary got the office vacancies much higher, faster than other people, stopped work on the project right now because the costs are just going out of whack. And he's got to go get refinancing. So it's a very, very challenging and risky proposition.
Can you build, Frank, this is a little off topic here, but can you build a building like that which is adaptable to both, which you could convert from one to the other quite easily for future use?
Well, it's possible, but you have to always, I mean, the office buildings are meant for office users.
Yeah.
And each office users, they tend to have their own demands of what they want in terms of space. And that changes quite dramatically as we know in office space, going from, you know, cubicles to offices to open a lot of boardrooms and conference rooms and so on. So, and having room for the computers and all the back, all the stuff that goes with the computers. It's in theory it's possible, but it's probably not very likely.
Obviously, there's a old, historic, beautiful armory here in Hamilton, and I haven't seen it on any list at this point. But as you mentioned, a pretty historic and unique building, and I'm sure if you make too many changes to that, you're going to raise the ire of a few different groups.
Yeah, it would be. I think the easiest way for with heritage buildings, I say the easiest way, the way that most development seems to be going now with heritage buildings is they preserve the facade. Mm-hmm. So that you see the exterior of the building there, but everything else is new.
All right, Frank Clayton with us, Senior Research Fellow with the Center for Urban Research and Land Development, Toronto Metropolitan University. The government floating around plans to turn old post office, historic armories, buildings of such into housing. Bit more complicated than first glance. Frank, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You're very welcome.
You may have seen this image. It's pretty bizarre to see a CPKC train. That's Canadian Pacific Kansas City train with five rail cars in flames as it's rolling in London, Ontario. This was happening Sunday night. And, the first thing is why don't you stop that and put that out? But as you see the way things progress, there's a method to the madness. Let's bring in Jacqueline LaBelle, Regional Ontario Online Supervisor for News Digital with Global, covering the London story. Jacqueline, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
This was a very bizarre image to see, and it had many frightened, I guess, that got the chance to see it live. How did this all happen?
Yeah, the images and the video as well. I find the video especially jarring just to see the moving train that's on fire.
Yeah.
So as you mentioned, it was Sunday night. Platoon chief with the London Fire Department, Colin Shewell, told us that they started receiving calls between 10 and 11 p.m., mostly from, I think, sort of like west of Richmond Street, if for anyone who's familiar over downtown London, because the train was moving, it was heading eastward. So they started receiving a bunch of calls, and they were able to get in touch with Canadian or CPKC. So as you mentioned, Canadian Pacific and Kansas City Southern, they merged in 2021. So I'm still getting used to calling it CPKC. Mm-hmm. Well, they got in contact with them and worked together to put out this fire once the train finally came to a stop at Waterloo Street and Pall Mall, which is fairly close to the Adelaide Yard, where there's a big train yard not far from there. So I think my guess is they were trying to get it out of the immediate downtown area.
So, and that was so weird to see this rolling through a residential area. There was a point when the engineer or engineers on the train were unaware that the train was on fire. Is that accurate?
To be honest, I don't know that for sure. I haven't received too much information from CPKC. The most that they've told me is that they were investigating. But Platoon Chief Colin Shewell, he had very high praise for their rail crews, said that they acted very professionally and worked quickly to, I know one of the things they did was I think they were able to disconnect some other train cars or rail cars from the train that may have had some other goods on it. So just to try and like contain the fire. And then he said they also, once they finally stopped, provided a lot of information to firefighters so that they knew exactly what they were dealing with. Fortunately, the five rail cars that were on fire, they were carrying wooden, I think they called them wooden railway ties.
Which yeah, railway ties, yeah. Look at,
Yeah, yeah. It's like the long wooden posts that they use to make railway tracks. So fortunately, it's not like it was like chemicals or something that was giving off any sort of noxious fumes, but there was a lot of smoke. They actually did ask people in the area to stay indoors and close their windows.
So it appears as if they were trying to navigate it to an area where they could sort of take it off the main line. It looks like it's sort of on a sideline and away from built-up areas. That's obviously what the plan is here when people saw a train rolling.
I'm trying to think through memory because I actually used to live pretty much right where the train stopped.
Yeah.
And I think it is just the one line for a bit, but just maybe like two or three blocks west is Richmond Row, which is like the downtown strip.
Right.
And there's huge condo buildings and apartment buildings and a bunch of bars and restaurants. Like it's a very busy area.
Yeah.
So a little bit more eastward. And I imagine that they were trying to get it towards the Adelaide Yard. I do know that once it finally stopped and once they got the flames under control, the CPKC rail crew and then a new round of firefighters, because they were pretty much battling it all night.
Yeah.
They went to the Adelaide Yard a couple streets further east, and that's where they finished kind of dousing hot spots. But it's definitely wild that it was moving while on fire for so long. I don't know if it took them some time or what the reasoning was, but it did finally come to stop. Also where it came to stop, there's the Drula Holding Building, which did suffer some damage. Firefighters were trying to protect it as best they could. But next to that, there's like a big parking lot. And across on the southern side of the street there, I'm trying to remember. I think it's kind of like a bit of a field, and then there's a smaller building. So it's not as dense there.
And any word on a cause at this point?
No, and that's, I mean, certainly I think everybody is interested in knowing that. I will note that I spoke with a CPKC spokesperson out of their Calgary office, and they would only say that they are investigating. Firefighters told us that the investigation is in the rail police's hands, but they did say that as far as they're concerned, it's suspicious until proven otherwise.
That's interesting. All right. Jacqueline LaBelle with us, Regional Ontario Online Supervisor for Global News Digital, covering the story in London about the train which caught fire. Jacqueline, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
You know, whenever we get tired of what's going up here, it's always fun to look down south of the border and see what's distracting them. And of course, the Donald Trump hush money trial continues. I'm fascinated because we keep hearing about gag orders, yet he keeps babbling like a brook. And it's like, do these have any impact whatsoever? Let's bring in Brian J. Karam, journalist, author, White House correspondent for Playboy, and political analyst for CNN with us now. Brian, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well. How about yourself?
So far, so good. One of the great things about this job, Brian, is I get to talk to people like you, people who are on the inside, people who are actually in the room with the president when all of this is going on, or presidents, and see how it all functions and such. So I cannot wait to ask you, Brian J. Karam, what is it with the stories and the former president passing wind in the courtroom? Is there any validity to this whatsoever? I know it's the pressing issue of the day.
Well, hey, he's been passing gas since I've seen him. I can't honestly say I have not been in the courtroom and witnessed that myself. What he has done is gaslighted America for the last 8 years, and that smells bad enough. I spoke with a neurologist today. I've been researching a story on Donald and his cognitive decline and the flatulence and the going off script and not finding words and mumbling and just making sounds is all indication of a man right on the cliff, about ready to fall over into, babbling dementia. You mentioned he babbles like a brook. Well, he'll keep doing it. We just won't be able to conjugate what it is that he's saying. I think Donald's in deep trouble. All of that aside, I think he's, by the end of the day, he may be cited for contempt of court. He's not appeared well in court. And I think he's, this is, this is Donald on the downside.
And the previous story is straight from Jimmy Kimmel, so we'll leave it as much. We'll leave that as it is. You mentioned when the former president starts to freelance, go off on his own, and I've noticed this, and you pointed this out for a while, but it's surprising that even when he does go out on his own and leave the script, that he brings so much into it. I mean, instead of staying on one thought and, you know, beginning, middle, and end, he just, it goes in every single direction. And that's really become noticeable, hasn't it?
Yeah. You know, when he's saying stuff like, you know, the Battle of Gettysburg.
Yeah.
Big battle. Don't know anything about it. Big battle. You know, oh, it's great. Or, you know, Canada, a nation to the north. I mean, he can't hold a thought. He doesn't make a thought. He doesn't. Honestly, it reminds me of my great grandfather towards the end of his life when he would, you know, blow bubbles in his suit.
Significance of this case. I mean, obviously, there's more serious ones on the docket. This obviously, you know, the Stormy Daniels case and such. How does this or will this compare to the others that are on the way?
Well, I think it's this particular case they said was the weakest, and I disagreed on one part of it. The facts are well known. He paid off Stormy Daniels. Now, he's just saying it's bad bookkeeping, but there is testimony that he was trying to, you know, pay her the hush money and hide it because he was running for president, which makes it a felony. So the facts are not in dispute. How you interpret them are, and he's now nailed into a courtroom for 8 hours a day. He can't get up and leave. He can't, you know, dance about and, you know, and riff and control the room. And there are 12 members of a jury who are watching his every move. And because I don't think any of that bodes well for Donald. I've spent time in a room with him, and if you've got to stare at him for more than 5 minutes, you want to vomit.
Is it a disadvantage that they're starting with this case in the sense that, you know, I don't mean to diminish it. He's done what he's done. But at the end of the day, it's a politician with a stripper or what have you. I don't think
dime a dozen in this country.
Well, you know, it happens. It happens with leadership. It's certainly nothing new. Right. Is the fact that this is more of that type of case than what the others are? Does it start it on less than a strong footing?
No, I think it's a very, I don't know that he spends time in prison for this. The question is it a felony or a misdemeanor? If they decide that it's a felony, if they prove that he's lying, then that man has some serious consequences to face with. I think it's 32 felonies in this one case alone. So and they only have to convict him on one. The pressure of being in that court every day and not campaigning is hurting him. I have seen 4 emails today. I'm being held hostage. They're trying to take my Trump Tower. It's all about me. They can't deny me a stage. I mean, he's just going nuts. And I don't think that boats. I still think there's a good chance he won't be on the ticket this fall. And I think this case, how it is adjudicated, will be determinant of that. I think that at the end of the day, if he is found guilty and he does face jail time, he may not ever go to jail, but it will certainly give the members of the Republican Party who now worship at his feet a good cause to leave him. Those who are controlling him, mind you, there are the sycophants who love him and bow down to him, and then those that are controlling him, the Steve Bannons and those people who want to tear the country down. They may never abandon Donald. That doesn't matter if the supporters and the sycophants who would vote for him will. And if they see that coming due to this case, then that could be very determinative of the outcome of the election.
Brian J. Karam with us, journalist, author, White House correspondent for Playboy, and political analyst for CNN, the hush money trial of Donald Trump. Oh, how come he doesn't have to be quiet if he's on a gag order all the time? He's babbling like a brook. Why is he not being held in contempt here?
He might be by the end of the day. I think more contemptible is his bodily functions. But, you know, that's... God bless him for that, that old fart. He might. And the thing is they do have to hold him accountable. And the judge did say today, he goes, look, you're not doing yourself a service here. He keeps saying that's in response to an email or to a text or a tweet. And he was talking about campaigning and he wasn't attacking Michael Cohen personally. And the judge has asked three times for, you know, show me that tweet. And they haven't done it. So by the end of the day, within the next hour or two, we may well find out that Donald Trump has been, you know, nicked for $10,000 because he can't keep his mouth shut.
Brian J. Karam, journalist, author, White House correspondent, Playboy, political analyst, CNN. Brian, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
You too, brother. Have a good one.
900-CHML, it's Hamilton Today. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900-CHML.
Well, we got it for 3 weeks. The pre-budget roadside distraction tour went on and on and on. However, the federal budget failed to spark the much-needed rebound in the polls the PM was looking for with the trailing Liberal Party, according to new Ipsos polling released today. Daryl Bricker is with us, CEO of Ipsos, and here now. Daryl, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
So the Prime Minister has said in the last several weeks, even months, that the problem with the party is that it's a communication issue, that Canadians are just not understanding what their policies are all about. And of course, we've seen a 3 week rollout of a budget, which normally takes a day or two. Can you use that excuse anymore? Are we well aware of what he's trying to sell?
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, what happens over time is political parties and political leaders develop a certain character, and people interpret everything they do through that impression of their character. And what you saw was the budget, I think, from the budget reaction was really a reflection of that. It's not just the message, it's the messenger.
Does it make things worse? Does it reinforce old thoughts?
Yeah, well, this time around, I mean, the purpose was to turn around people's perspectives of this government, and particularly its economic management. When you take a look at all the questions that we asked and the answers that we got back in terms of how Canadians feel about this particular budget and this particular government, they're certainly not encouraging.
Give us some of your results.
So we asked people whether or not they would symbolically give the budget two thumbs up, two thumbs down, or they just shrug their shoulders. Two thumbs up, like I really like this, 17%. Two thumbs down, 40%. 43% say they just shrugged their shoulders. A full 28% said they didn't even know. Like they didn't even know that there had been a budget that had taken place. So, you know, among the people that that noticed this, it's pretty much 2-1 saying that they just don't like it compared to the percentage that do like it. But probably a more telling question, Scott, is really asking people whether or not they think that this budget and what was in it will personally help them or will personally hurt them. 4-1, people saying it will hurt them over help them, which is really surprising, especially given that even among people like, for example, the Gen Z and millennials, who the budget was really focused on, it's 2-1 at least, saying more likely to hurt than to help.
And this was specifically, I mean, in previous budgets and previous everything, we hear middle class, and those trying to join it. He's even broken that down to the young. Is that resonating with this super hyper focus on those that once put him where he was?
All income categories, all age groups, all genders, every demographic that we tracked on this survey, and we track a lot of them, every single one had a more negative impression than positive impression.
Capital gains tax making a lot of hay, and the Prime Minister again positioning this as if it's a tax on the ultra rich. It's not a tax on the middle class. Yet we're seeing people who have small businesses or tradespeople who are investing in other things, other vehicles, and such, and even the family cottage Are Canadians buying that only the ultra-rich can have a family cottage?
Well, as we saw earlier with this government, when they decided to go after small businesses, The reaction that they got when they tried to present it as a class-based type argument was so strong that they ended up backing down. So it'll be interesting to see what happens on capital gains. I would say that most people, when they hear the expression capital gains tax, the only word they hear out of it is tax.
Yeah.
And this is not a time in which people are saying that we need to be taxing more than we're currently taxing. In fact, we asked people whether or not there was too much of a focus on spending in this budget. 60% of us, of the people that we interviewed, said that there was. So the issue is that they feel that this government is one that probably spends too much in comparison to the effect that it has in terms of the day-to-day lives of Canadians, and that when it resorts to taxes, it may not necessarily be the best thing to do.
That is very odd, considering where we've been in the past. How long has it been since you've seen something like this? How surprised are you by all this?
I was really surprised, given that they threw as much as anybody could throw at this budget. And the best reaction that you could possibly say that people have from it is, you know, I just don't care. But really, when you go down into the detail of the data, it's clear that there was a significant number of Canadians who were watching, at least three quarters. And those who did watch did not come back with the impression that the government wanted them to have after hearing everything that they've heard over the last couple of weeks about the budget.
Are Canadians turning out to be a little smarter than what everybody thought they would be? For example, the rebranding exercises that haven't worked. As you just said, people digging down a little deeper and realizing, and again, this is something that they haven't really looked at for a long time, but realizing it's not necessarily the best for them.
Now, that's what we're seeing. What we're really seeing, though, Scott, is just a real desire for change.
Yeah.
The highest that I've seen it at the federal level in a long time, 75% of people that we interviewed said it's time for a change in the government. We need somebody else to govern.
That's huge, isn't it, Daryl?
Yeah, I don't know how you come back from that, really. It's, I'm supposed to say anything can happen, but what that anything isn't obvious.
Still another budget between now and the next election. If it goes that far, will we see another Hail Mary like this? How do you ride this out? How do you get through that wall, as you say?
Well, as we saw with Kathleen Wynne, when she was in the tail end of her government, she threw everything out there that she could possibly do as well. And the reaction was pretty much the same. So I think that the Trudeau Liberals have kind of reached that period of their mandate where they're, unless they can come up with something new and different, that's really, really appealing to Canadians, they'd rather give somebody else a chance to govern the country.
Obviously, whenever anybody asks if the prime minister is leaving, that's met with a no and don't even go there. That's not even on the docket. Now that's changing. Issues with meetings that are going on and such in this past week. Is that, do you think, a viable option for the Liberals, changing leadership?
Well, it is one of the options. I mean, the problem that they have, Scott, is that they're dependent on the NDP to continue to govern. And mm-hmm. the NDP's got to be looking at numbers like this and saying to themselves, why are we attaching ourselves to this? This may be the time when they could, if we're going to be in a change election, where they can even take the official opposition role away from the Liberals. I mean, the NDP ended up in third in 2015. They were supposed to win that election. Maybe this is an opportunity if they decide to go to the people for the NDP to move into second place and put the Liberals back into third.
What's odd, Daryl, is the NDP hasn't even approved this yet, but that doesn't seem to be making the news.
No, it hasn't. But I will say that when they see numbers like this, and by the way, we're not the only poll that's come out in the last couple of days showing very similar things. And they're, you know, both the Liberals and NDP are probably looking at their own polling and seeing exactly what you and I are talking about today. It's got to raise some very interesting questions in both the NDP caucus room, not just the Liberal caucus room.
The next year or so are going to be fascinating. Daryl Bricker, CEO of Ipsos Polling, the new budget not paying off for the Prime Minister and the Liberals in the polls. Daryl, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
Well, here we go again. Honda Canada is, this rumor started to float out in the last day or so. Nothing official as yet. We understand that's coming up later in the week. But Honda Canada, the rumors are, is set to build an electric vehicle battery plant near its auto manufacturing facility in Alliston, Ontario. Also plans to produce fully electronic vehicles. Senior sources are saying that this is coming down, waiting information later in the week. David Booth with us, senior writer, Postmedia Driving, driving.ca. And here now, David, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm very well, in fact. Thank you very much.
So, David, what do we know about this deal? What can you tell us?
Well, we don't know anything for absolutely certain, but yeah. Certainly there are certain things that we can put together. We think there's not only a battery manufacturing plant, but an EV assembly plant as well. And as well, they're going to do some of the supply chain stuff, like the cathodes as well. So it's probably the most complete infrastructure, if the conjecture is true, that we've seen in quite some time. It'd be like having a traditional assembly plant plus an engine plant plus, say, a transmission plant. Like, it's big news.
And, you know, that is an interesting part of this story, David, because when you're saying battery plant, what exactly do you mean? Where are the minerals coming? Where are the raw supplies coming to build these? Are they coming from dirty players? Are they going to be coming from Canada or North America? What is involved in a battery manufacturing plant?
Well, there's the source of the minerals will almost assuredly be Canada. It makes no sense since we have lots. And it's one of the things that we were planning on selling to the world. In fact, I think Mercedes has a contract with us to ship some outside of the country. So we have lots of that stuff. And one assumes, I mean, you know, I'm not in the mine or in the areas themselves checking on it, but we have strict and rigorous environmental laws. So, I mean, basically, we're going to be doing, as I said, much of the entire supply chain. I mean, to soup to nuts, as it were. I mean, I'm assuming we're going to be mining it. We're going to be sourcing lithium. We're going to be sourcing, I'm assuming, nickel, manganese, and cobalt. Maybe not cobalt here, because we have some of that. And then we're going to build that. I believe it's the cathodes specifically, which is a major part of the battery. We're going to then assemble the cells, I believe, if it follows the pattern here in Canada, and put them in battery packages. And then what's unique is that battery package will then go into a car that seemingly will also be assembled in Allison. So far, the ones that have built, like a Volkswagen, we're all assuming the batteries built here will go to the States. Stellantis, some of the batteries may be used here, but I suspect the preponderance will go to the States as well. The fact is, Honda is fairly unique by being all in for all parts of the supply chain.
We remember the premier saying that that's what his intention was right from the minerals all the way to the production and assembly of the vehicles. But do we have access to those mines? Are we mining enough of that in Canada now? And perhaps I'm asking the wrong guy.
No. I have some information about that. I mean, the biggest problem we have is probably that our approval processes take.
Because we always hear about the Ring of Fire and how valuable it is, but we can't get a road built up to it. So, I mean, are we going to end up assembling these things here and then just buying the parts or the pieces from dirty players?
No. I'm going to be optimistic. I remember this plant probably, or series of plants, won't probably become fully operational till 2028. Possibly fully operational by 2029. So I really want to believe that we can get our ducks in a row by then. I really do want to believe that we can get a mine approved and a road built and everything else. I mean, God help us if we can't. Then we'll deserve all of the lack of productivity we keep hearing about.
Comparing this, and again, we don't really know the nuts and bolts of the deal, but maybe on size, that sort of thing. How does this deal with Honda compare to the others, say VW, what have you?
Well, because it's a couple of plants, the EV assembly plant and a battery plant. I mean, even if they're in the same building, they'll be separate plants. Yeah. It should be much bigger than the Stellantis battery plant or the Volkswagen battery plant. And the Volkswagen one's pretty darn big. It's also financed completely different. It gets complicated, but the Stellantis and the Volkswagen, and yes, the Northvolt, I believe in Quebec as well, is financed. The monies that we've heard, tens of billions of dollars that those companies were being given, is financed in matching the numbers that would come from an IRA. It's the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States. And basically, what it does is subsidizes to the tunes of about $45 a kilowatt hour every battery a plant makes. So it's a running subsidy. And if you had a plant up today, like what they call a gigafactory, you'd probably get about $1 billion a year in rolling subsidies. Now, this one won't start till 2029. So what they're doing, instead of saying, oh, well, I'll take some money in 2029, Honda's getting a whole bunch of money up front to build the plant. Okay, so they're going to get more than Stellantis and Volkswagen, I suspect, for the production of the plant. They'll get less on the back end. And basically, right, there's a choice. You can get the money for building the building, or you can get a subsidy to produce batteries over the long haul. The reports are, I mean, we don't know, it's all conjecture, that Honda's chosen to take the money up front.
David Booth, senior writer, Post Media Driving, driving.ca, Honda Canada, expanding the Allison facility to include battery plant and EV plant. David, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you very much.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
Lots of fallout from the budget, which took about 3 weeks to unveil. So we all certainly understand it. We understand what the government is trying to do. There's no comm issue here. We figured it out. And we're starting to see the fallout from it. It was supposed to tax the ultra rich. Now we're finding out, it's everybody from your family doctor to, a family with a cottage that they've had in the family for years. Let's bring in Dr. Joss Reimer, president-elect of the Canadian Medical Association, and get their feeling of these new increases and how it will affect the doctor population in this country. Josh, thank you for the time. Hope you're doing well.
I am doing well. Thanks for having me.
So, Doctor, how are others in your field reacting to this? How are members of the Canadian Medical Association digesting this?
You know, the number one thing that I hear is worry from our members about what this is going to do for physician recruitment and physician retention. We've already got so many challenges with people having access to healthcare, particularly primary care. So anything that discourages people from going into family medicine and from doing primary care is really concerning to all of us.
For some reason, many people think doctors are all incredibly rich. And they should and do make a good living and my goodness, take care of us all. But you're also running a small business with expenses just like any other small business is part of that. Can you explain how it all works?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So if you think about your average family doctor's office, they may own the building or they rent the building. And so they're paying the electricity, the water, the rent. They're also hiring the staff. So the secretary at the front, maybe the nurse that does your blood pressure, the person in the back doing all the finances, those all come out of the doctor's income. And so how we organize things is we have them incorporate. And so when we're talking about the capital gains, we're actually not talking about the personal one with the $250,000 exemption. We're talking about the corporate ones, which has no minimum. Yeah. And so when the doctors incorporate, that's how they save money for retirement. The vast majority of us are not eligible for pensions. And so our corporations are where we save money so that when we're ready to retire, we have that money sitting there able to support our families through that retirement. So the numbers that you see for what a family doctor makes, because a lot of times we do release those publicly, those don't include the fact that you're hiring multiple people, you're renting property, you're paying utilities, all of that comes out of that family physician's income.
We certainly know about the shortage and the crisis that we're all feeling right now, especially in a post-pandemic world. And we're at a place at a time where we're trying to attract or retain doctors. What does this do? How do doctors view this? If you're, you know, should I go to family medicine or not?
That's exactly what we're worried about. And we've had great conversations with this government about improvements to the healthcare system And so, you know, we want to continue that conversation here because some of the unintended consequences are that people are going to look at family medicine and go, you know, oh, that looks really expensive. And this is just one extra thing that's causing people to reconsider. I don't think this by itself is going to make or break the difference, but with all of the extra paperwork that they're doing, all the demands on their time, with running a small business, and then also getting this extra tax when you're ready to retire, when you've put in your many decades of work, you know, that's where we're really worried. We want Canadians to have access to primary care. That's why we all went into this job. We care about the health of Canadians. And so I want to see our doctors go into primary care and love it and feel fulfilled and feel supported. And anything that goes against that is worrying to me.
You talked about unintended consequences. Are you surprised by this? Because it just doesn't think like it's or feel like it's been fought through.
You know, the taxes are complicated. I'm not going to claim to understand the budget because it is really complicated. And most people don't really realize that physicians run corporations. They don't realize that, you know, when we get paid, it goes into the corporation. And we do pay income tax, but we pay it later when we pull that money out. And so the capital gains that you pay when you take out an investment, as well as the income tax you pay when you pay yourself with that investment, people don't think about that for physicians, and I don't want them to have to think about it. So it's really unfortunate that we're having to talk about it, but it is important that we do everything we can to try to promote healthcare in this country.
Rather than more tax or taxing physicians more or what have you, what should we be doing to try to bring, in effect, these small business people into the system to bring healthcare to Canadians? What do we need to do? How do we attract them as opposed to, oh, here's another obstacle?
Well, we really want to see physicians feeling supported. And that means doing things like supporting team-based care. We've had a system where, especially the family doc, but doctors in general end up being sort of the one and only person that you go to. And we know that there's lots of expertise out there in dietitians and physiotherapists, physician assistants, that we could do better if we worked as a team. So we really want to move our system towards having primary care teams rather than just the singular family doctor who has to do everything. And that would go a long way to reducing the stress. You know, I've worked in a clinic where I was a singular family or a singular doctor, and then I worked in another one where I had a team. And it was so much better for me, but even more importantly, better for my patients when they could go and talk to the physiotherapist about the hip pain that they were having or the dietitian about their diabetes diet that they needed to follow. So that's one of the things that we really want to see as a move. We also want to help do things like pan-Canadian licensure so doctors can move around the country to address where the needs are the greatest. There's lots of things we could be doing to help improve our healthcare system. And we just want to flag this as one issue where we need to have more conversations with the government to make sure that we aren't accidentally causing some additional stress on our healthcare system.
Do you think this, where do you think this conversation's going, Joss? Do you think that this is over? Is this set in stone?
I never think anything's set in stone. And I know that our politicians want to make decisions that are what they see best for Canadians as well. And so that's, you know, that's what we in the Canadian Medical Association see as our job, is to try to make sure that the decision makers have all the information that they need when they're making these decisions. And so we are happy to meet and happy to provide that insight, that experience from what our members are seeing on a day-to-day basis, anytime that they're willing to chat with us.
Dr. Joss Reimer with us, President-elect Canadian Medical Association, concerned and talking about the federal government's proposed increase to capital gains and what that will do to attract or hoping to retain doctors in the future. Thank you so much for the time, Dr. Be well.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate the opportunity.
We've talked an awful lot about the rapid population growth, the explosion that we've seen in Canada over the last couple of years. And unfortunately, taxing systems and just not having the services needed to house everybody, whether it's housing, healthcare, all the way down to the shelter system. In Canada, of course, a land of immigrants. I'm first generation Canadian. Everybody knows somebody who is or was or what have you. But again, you've got to be prepared for that. An interesting article in the Globe and Mail by John Ibbotson, writer at large with the Globe and Mail. And the headline is, the Liberals' immigration policies have accomplished the opposite of what was intended in its well-meaning effort to encourage the migration of international students to Canada. The Trudeau government is turning swaths of our post-secondary education system into a grift. And to talk more about all of this, John Ibbotson with us now. John, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Thanks, Scott. Happy to be here.
I think, John, what frustrates a lot of people with this, and again, I think Canada is a pretty sympathetic country when it comes to immigrants and want to do our part, and we need immigrants to fill jobs and such. But I think what makes this frustrating for a lot of Canadians is that a lot of this is self-inflicted. And you know, the government was told a couple of years ago that these targets were too high, that you were going to stress an already stressed housing system, healthcare, everything, right down to the shelter system. And yet they went ahead and did it anyway. How do you do that in on such a large scale and not think there's going to be repercussions?
I don't know how you do that on such a large scale and not think there's going to be repercussions, because in fact, there have been repercussions. One of the, not only one of, the greatest single advantage Canada has had over almost every other country for decades now is that most Canadians supported the idea of robust immigration. We've had, Brian Mulroney was the first to sort of open the gates to bring in 250,000 people a year. John Chrétien and Paul Martin maintained that. Stephen Harper grew it a little bit. And it allowed us to bring in a large number of people from all over the world, different parts of the world, who contributed successfully to Canadian society. The Trudeau government wanted to expand the program. Great idea. Canada's an aging society. We have labor shortages showing up everywhere. We need young workers, not only to fill those jobs, but to pay the taxes and buy the goods that sustain the economy and look after the services needed for old folks like me. So this was all a good idea. But they ratcheted up the numbers very quickly. And as you said, they ignored warnings that they didn't have enough systems in place to house these people and absorb them into society. Worse than that, because I think we could have managed the 500,000 landed immigrants more or less. But worse than that, we started bringing in huge numbers of foreign students. Again, a great idea. Send them to our universities and colleges. Give them a good Canadian diploma degree. Give them a work permit and permanent resident status. They'll be paying taxes for decades before they actually need any health care of their own. But they came in far beyond the numbers that anybody had anticipated. The government had no clue this was going to happen. A lot of them went to so-called puppy mills, private colleges that don't really give much of an education at all. Mm. And they were just there to get the work permit and eventually hope to get a permanent resident status. There's over a million of them in the country now. So you have two bad things. First of all, you have this system being exploited along with, you know, housing shortages and people unable to use the various services and systems that are in place, overloading them, crowding them out. And you have, even worse, a whole bunch of polls now that show the Canadian attitudes towards immigration have changed. Now most Canadians think there are too many people coming into the country, and that's a terrible thing.
It is, but is that changeable, John? I mean, I don't think Canadians are becoming unsympathetic towards immigrants. It's just they're not happy with the policy because it, at this point, it just doesn't work. It doesn't fit.
You're absolutely right. I think there was a time when if you opposed immigration, people would say, well, you know, you're racist or you don't want newcomers coming into the country. And some of that was true. Some of the people who were opposed to immigration were people who wanted to keep the old Canada the way it was. But now, even people like me, I'm a pretty robust pro-immigration supporter, are beginning to question whether the system is out of control. So I think either this government or the next government, whatever that next government might be, needs to start restoring confidence in the system. We need to show that we're bringing in as many people as can find jobs, but also can find homes and without pressing other people out of the market. We need to try to restore the consensus in favor of immigration. And to do that, we need to make immigration work again.
As you pointed out, the intention, there was a good intention here. The idea was a good idea. It just appears, as it does with a lot with this government, it just being incomplete policy, policy that just hasn't been thought through in even the simplest, most basic form. How do you fix that?
I'm not sure how you fix it. We're in what I called in the column whack-a-mole policy phase. So the government creates wide-open immigration that produces tremendous housing shortages. What do we do? All right, we're going to spend tens of billions of dollars to try to goose housing construction, as this latest budget does. But in order to pay for that, because the budget deficits are through the roof, they decide that they have to start increasing the capital gains tax. But that's going to hurt productivity. So the next budget will probably go after productivity. And you just go, well, that's one thing, and that's another thing, and that produces another thing. I don't think there is any policy coherence to the Liberal government right now.
Obviously, when we talk about housing and the crisis there, I mean, it appears build has been a bad word for decades. It's going to take another decade to catch up. So that's not a quick fix. Is there a quick fix here? Obviously, the Prime Minister realized he made a mistake because then he capped both international students and temporary workers. Is that how we gain or regain control of this?
Well, it's the first step. I don't know how we, it has to be the first step of many, and you're right, nothing is going to fix this overnight. We need to restore the student visa program to what it's supposed to be, a means by which students come to this country, get a good education in an accredited, reputable school, and then join the Canadian workforce, hopefully become permanent residents and contribute to society. We have to, so that means shutting down puppy mills. It also means telling community colleges that they have to bring their attendance back in line with reality. They too are not there just to churn out students. They're there to graduate properly educated students. So that has to be at least a start. Caps on the number of people coming in as well. Beyond that, it means, yes, as you said, bringing the housing market back in line with demand. But that's not going to happen quickly.
You talked about our attitudes towards immigration and generally positive. Do you think Canadians, even at this point, blame immigrants or immigration, or do they blame bad policy, bad government policy?
Well, I hope they blame bad government policy, because that's who's to blame. You can't fault
students
or temporary foreign workers or permanent residents or anyone else who is given a visa or permanent resident status to come to Canada. They're not at fault. They are pursuing an opportunity. They are bravely, because it's a pretty brave thing to do, leaving their homes, their family, their country, their culture, and coming to a new land and making a new start, just as your family did and my family did and millions of others' families did. So we don't blame them. We celebrate them, I hope. But we do blame the government, by the way, provincial as well as federal, because there's provincial culpability in this program as well, for letting the system get under control.
John Ibbotson with us, writer-at-large with the Globe and Mail, and his latest there, the Liberals' immigration policies have accomplished the opposite of what was intended. John, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thanks, Scott.
Coming up after the 6 o'clock news, Scott Radley Show. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, thanks for the time. I hope you are well.
I am fantastic. Scott, how are you?
Good. How about those Leafs?
How about those Leafs? You know, we talked last night on the show about how it is, you know, people are just, there's a point at which it just is, why put yourself through it? When you know what the outcome is going to be, what's the point of watching when you just know that every year is going to be another kick in the pants? And I was saying that I had a friend who is a diehard Leaf fan who didn't even watch the first game of the series because he says, I know where this ends up. Why do I want to torture myself? Well, you know what? We were talking about that last night. Full marks to the Leafs. They played a really good game. They got a win in Boston that I don't believe they have got a win in Boston since 1847. I think that was their last win there. Yeah. And Austin Matthews was amazing. Ilya Samsonov, who had been pretty mediocre, and that's maybe being generous, in game one, was terrific. You know what? Full marks to them for doing it. Now, having said all this, people who have been Leafs fans for long enough understand what this means is, okay, we're not going to get swept. We're going to make it as painful as possible and find a way to torture you in game seven.
Drag us out to seven games.
However, at least they are putting up a fight, and who knows? Maybe this is the year for the miracle, Scott.
So many have said, like, you know, why are these two teams playing in the first round? And obviously that division is tougher, la, la, la. I don't want to get into that. I'm way above my head here. But is this the toughest team they'll play if they keep going? Is this a good gauge?
It is a tough team, but if they win this, their next round will be, in all likelihood, against the Florida Panthers, who I would argue, and many would, are even better and tougher. Yeah. And it's, you know what, here's the thing. And again, I go back to the, you know, how do the Leafs torment you? Well, for all for a generation or two with Harold Ballard and then everything that came after it,
yeah,
they were terrible. And when they finally get their generational player and finally get some guys around him who are really good players, what happens? That's the time when the teams, they first of all, the NHL changes the playoff format, so you have to play your way through your division first. Mm-hmm. And that's the time when your division becomes the all-time powerhouse division of the NHL. You had Tampa running through and winning Stanley Cups. You had Boston before that running through and winning Stanley Cups. You've got Florida now going to the Stanley Cup finals last year. You know, you just, you know, it's almost like it's a some sort of cosmic joke that when you finally become a really good team, all the other really good teams are in your division and you have to get through them. Because, I mean, look, I think it's a reasonable thing, Scott, to say that had the Leafs been in, say, the Metropolitan Division, they probably would have been in, I would argue, a couple, at least semifinals. Now, that's not, you know, that's not winning a Stanley Cup, but I am convinced that over the years, they probably would have got out of their division and won a few playoff rounds. But you are stuck in this division and then you don't have it, whatever it is. And so you just suffer and suffer and suffer, which made yesterday's game, the predictions, I think every Leaf fan was right to believe, ugh, look at that first game. Here we go again. Made it a very pleasant surprise for everybody last night.
So, care to make any predictions moving forward? I mean, let's be honest. Austin finally broke through, got goal number 70. Look out, is the floodgate open now?
It was a great goal, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, beautiful.
So, I'll tell you what. I you know how much I hate making predictions. I will make you a prediction.
Which is why I asked.
I know. I will make you a prediction after tomorrow night's game. And the reason I'll say that is because I at this point, truly, like Samsonov was, as I say, in net, he was terrific after a not very good game. Can he do that twice in a row? Can he, is that a confidence boost that now he's feeling it and you can maybe have a goalie who's as good as the other team's goalie? Is that as good a game as Austin Matthews can play and he reverts back to just pretty good? Is Mitch Marner ever going to show up in this series? Is William Nylander going to play? Like there's, let's see what happens when you get, now we've had two games out of the way. I promise I will give you a prediction after game three and we'll get a sense. Because right now you've seen two entirely different Toronto Maple Leaf teams wearing the same uniform, but they were not even remotely the same group of players. So let's see what happens now that everyone's got their feet under them. Was that first game difficult because they were so tight and they know the story of Toronto playoff problems? Were they just nervous and tight and weren't playing right and now they've got to win and they're going to relax and just play their game? Or was yesterday a fluke? I don't know, Scott, because this team doesn't generally let us know what it's going to do game to game. Not in the playoffs.
And thank goodness for all that I've learned about betting in the last year or so, that you're allowed to wait until halfway through the series to place your bet. I think that's still allowed. So you
would you ahead. Would you honestly? I mean, look, I don't know if you're a bettor. I'm not a betting guy.
I'm too cheap.
Well, yeah, me too. And but okay, let's say that I gave you $100 and I said, I'll tell you what, you can bet this on the Leafs, or you can go out and take your wife for a nice dinner. Are you confident enough in what you might see from the Leafs to think I could double my money? Or are you saying, forget that, I'm going for dinner?
Oh, I'm out. Are you kidding me? No way. I'm taking the money and running.
I would have no idea who to wager on because, again, this team is so wildly unpredictable in the playoffs. In the regular season, you know, the only predictable thing in the regular season was that they would play really well against good teams and really badly against bad teams. That was all the time, and that drove people nuts. But in the playoffs, you should say, okay, well, then it's all good teams, therefore you should be good all the time. No, they still are up and down and up and down. So who knows, Scott? I have no clue what you will see tomorrow. But, you know, maybe, as I say, Nylander comes back from this weird, mysterious injury that no one knows anything about, and maybe Mitch Marner makes an appearance, and maybe, there's so many maybes, who knows?
Dinner or the Leafs? Both may give you gas. Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Very, have a great one.
Very, very true. Well done.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one from Heather. The U.S. will build a high-speed rail line between Vegas and Los Angeles, done by 2027. 3 years. Everyone can build, but Canada. We can't get from Eastgate to McMaster. Why has build been a bad word in Canada? Tell me. Keep right, accept a pass.